You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I'm Julie Broadway, president of the American Horse Council.
And I'm Emily Stearns, health, welfare, and regulatory affairs liaison for the American Horse Council.
And you are listening to the special monthly American Horse Council episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for February 2026.
It's time to hear from the American Horse Council in this monthly episode of Horses in the Morning.
Did you know that there are over 300,000 mules and donkeys in the United States? We last chatted about these long-eared, big-hearted folks in 2024, so it's time to give them some more love and some more attention.
And in our last long-ear episode, we talked about the differences between the physiological differences between donkeys and mules and horses, and why it's important that mules and donkeys get their own research and health considerations. And this round, we are going all in on the long ear side of the industry.
Totally. We are here to support all equines, donkeys, mules. Everybody's so important, and their contributions are great as working animals, companion animals, recreational animals, competition animals. The list goes on and on, Emily.
Yeah, and I remember when it made big news that the first mule was competing at the U.S. Dressage Finals all the way back in 2014. And I went back to look it up just for this episode. Her name was Dinah, and her rider was Laura Hermanson.
Oh, and that was a really big deal, I think.
Yeah, and I even found they did a little documentary about it called Dinah Does Dressage that was hosted on Vimeo. I will post the link in the show notes. It's a little old, so sometimes the link was being a little fussy for me, but it's a pretty fun watch.
Well, I have to say, so mules and donkeys are used in a lot of different ways in our industry. They can be pack animals, and also on the working side of things, there's a carriage operator in New Orleans exclusively only using mules.
Yeah, and he said that the drivers report they handle the heat and humidity much better than the standard heavy draft horses and have all the strength without the heft.
Yes, so I shouldn't say the word very cool because it's not necessarily cool in New Orleans, but our guest today is our old friend, Dr. Amy McLean, and she's here to talk to us about all aspects of long ear competition. Mules and donkeys are being used in a lot of different disciplines. And so first, we want to get a word from our sponsor for this first part of the episode. So our episode today is brought to you from Zoetis. They are a proud partner of the American Horse Council and have been supporting horses, riders, veterinarians, and others for over 70 years. That's including all the mules and donkeys. They offer all of over 50 products, from industry-leading vaccines to expert-recommended dewormers and other equid health solutions. Zoetis is always by your side to help you to do what's right for your equid. So visit zoetisequine.com to learn more.
We're excited to welcome back Dr. Amy McLean, long ear extraordinaire. Dr. McLean, please take a moment to introduce yourself and your work in the long ear world.
Well, thank you, Emily, and thank you, Julie, for having me today. It's always exciting to talk about mules and donkeys and to talk about kind of the fun and the competitive side of these great long-eared and interesting creatures. I'm at the University of California, Davis. I'm an associate professor here in the equine science program. And my concentration of research is on donkeys and mules, travel to a lot of developing countries. And in my spare time, when I'm not riding or showing my mule, Big Star Sarge, I try to donate my time to various charities that work with working equids, which are a lot of donkeys and mules around the globe, such as the Equitarian Initiative and the American Fonduke.
Awesome. So tell us personally, do you have some history in competing with mules and donkeys?
Well, that's a great question, Julie. Yes, I do. So I try to ride daily. I'm an equestrian and I compete with my mule Sarge at a lot of different open horse shows where we're allowed. And he's also been very competitive on the mule circuit. And Sarge is one of many just amazing mules I've known throughout my lifetime. My dad introduced me to a donkey when I was a baby. His name was PJ, and he was a guard donkey. And he was from Atlanta, Georgia. My mom was from Manhattan. They were both, as we could say, city slickers. And when he introduced me to PJ, he looked at my mom and said, "We're moving out of the city and we're getting a donkey and mule farm." So that's what happened. My parents are very spontaneous, knew nothing about mules and donkeys, which is really interesting because a lot of owners today fall into that category. They've never owned a horse. They've never owned, you know, a large animal, and they end up getting a donkey and then they get a mule or vice versa. But we started showing when I was about 5 years old or maybe a little bit younger. And I showed a big Palomino mule named Hollywood. And he was, kind of like a California blonde, I guess we can say, if we can say that.
A Barbie second, mule. Yeah.
A Barbie mule. Yes, that's what he was. And he was so kind and gentle. And so started out showing Hollywood. Then I had Polly the mule, and she was really funny. She didn't care for my dad, but I could do anything in the world with her. And later on studying mule behavior, that is true. Mules pick their people who they like because they're so smart. That's a little bit of my
A little discerning, are they?
So, starting with that statement, like, can you give some context just about the overall, your experience kind of nationally with what's going on in the donkey and mule world, just kind of, you know, just on that side of the industry? I feel like there's this whole secret side of the industry that maybe a lot of traditional horse people might not really understand the scope of.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the mule and donkey show world, similar to a lot of specialized breeds, sadly, it's gotten smaller over the years. But as a kid, we traveled all over the country, Georgia, Florida, North Carolina, South Carolina, Illinois, Texas. Most of the state fairs or livestock shows had a mule and donkey show, and they really attracted an audience. And I know we've all been to horse shows and it's like, where's the audience? Unless it's an exciting Grand Prix or rodeo, a lot of times horse shows sadly are missing an audience. But mule and donkey shows would attract audience because they're different, they're cute, they make a different sound. And some of my favorite family pictures are from actually Columbia, South Carolina, the South Carolina State Fair Donkey and Mule Show, which is still going to this day. And I'm probably 5 or 6 in the picture. Now I'm going to tell y'all how old I am. That was about 47 years ago. So they have lasted in a lot of places. And then other places, sadly, like some of our breed shows have gotten smaller, diminished. California is super cool because we have a very active mule association called the American Mule Association. And there's a mule and donkey show circuit out here. And it's grown into some of the other Western states. And what's really fun about mules and donkeys, they're expected to do everything. So they're truly an all-around competition animal. So when I say everything, my mule Sarge started out competing in hunter hack, hunter under saddle, Western events. And today he does everything from cutting, cow work, driving, dressage. He's wonderful at jumping in the hunter division. Western riding, trail, pleasure, showmanship. And he's been able to hang with the horses in a lot of this competition as well. So if he had a horse, it'd be very specialized. It would just do English, it'd just do Western, it'd just do maybe dressage. But mules so far have not specialized to that area.
Well, you just answered one of my basic questions, which was, what all disciplines could they go in? Because I was kind of thinking through that in my head. Like, I have a friend who's with the Western Dressage Association. I can so see donkeys and mules being really competitive there. You said hunter jumpers, you talked about cutting, all these other disciplines I hadn't even considered a donkey or a mule for.
I used to farm sit for someone who would hunter pace their mammoth jack.
Very cool.
And he was great at it. I, you know, they didn't, they didn't do the first flight, but he was great at it. He ate it up.
So the question then, Amy, is what would you say are the best traits they bring to the show ring? I mean, people don't necessarily think about mules and donkeys in certain disciplines, but you have seen it in action. So what are the great things that they bring?
Well, the biggest thing they bring, and we've actually just done a study looking at their muscle morphology and how it varies. They're so athletic, and that's why they're able to compete in a lot of these different events, is just because of that level of athleticism that goes back to the horse cross and the donkey cross. And there's certain breeds of donkeys too. I think people are always kind of amazed at that, like a breed of donkey. They're not all gray and look like Shrek. No, they don't. So there's about 200 breeds of donkeys, and some of your Spanish breeds of donkeys, like the Andalusians, the Catalonians, the Ragusana from Italy, the Pegas from Brazil, those donkeys have been selected to produce athletic mules. And they have different angles to their shoulders, to their hips. And then from a muscle fiber standpoint, there's a great combination of different muscle types. So they can have a quick spurt of energy, or they can sail over a jump or slow it down and do one of, you know, the flat type classes. So, yeah, it's hybrid vigor at its best for sure. Are we ever going to see them in the Olympics? I would love to see that, but realistically, probably not, because they are very versatile. So they're good at a lot of events, sometimes great, but we don't have that level of specialization yet in the industry.
Okay, so hold on. Wait.
Okay, we both got questions.
Every time you bring up the 200 breeds of donkeys, you brought that up in 2024 too, and I remember being like, what? Go back. So I'm stuck on that again, but also I'm now, the nerd in me is stuck on you saying that not only do we have different breeds of donkeys, but the donkey breeds have been selected specifically for the type of mules they're making, which is like such a step further than what we need to think about when we're breeding horses. So can you talk about that for like 30 seconds, about how that selection is working and how that feeds into kind of a competition mule a little bit?
Yeah. So again, just like horses, the donkeys are being selected to be taller, more athletic, different angles to their shoulders, their hips, longer necks, because donkeys traditionally have a short neck and a very upright shoulder, upright pelvis to walk around a desert with their boxy hooves so they don't sink and to not expend a lot of energy. But in some ways, we're selecting them more like horses for performance and quality of movement. And then we're seeing that trait, of course, come down into the mule. So the Pega donkey from Brazil is also a great example. It's crossed with some local breeds of horses in various states in Brazil that are gated. And the Pega donkey itself is gated, like a gated horse. But they love mules on ranches in Brazil. That's their number one go-to equid to work cattle. So they have a smooth gait, they can cover a lot of ground, and then the mule's very agile in doing cattle work.
So I have to ask this question, because Emily asked the one I was thinking, but now that you've said all that, since the guy that we spoke to in New Orleans used exclusively mules for his carriage driving operations because they handle heat and humidity, do mules and donkeys do really well in endurance?
Oh, that's a great question. There's been quite a few mules that have completed the Tevis, haven't won it yet. They've competed in the Tevis, which is... I'm not an endurance expert by any means, but I know the country out here, and that's held here in California in the Sierra, and the mountains are rugged, and it's 100 miles, you know, going up and down.
Up and down, yep.
Yeah, and the mules are so sure-footed, again, because of the conformation of their hoof, which partly is related to their dad, the donkey. So they do really well at that, and it's my understanding as well is when they go through the vet checks, they have a great ability to recover their heart rate.
Right, heart rate,
and their blood chemistry is also very stabilized. We've tried to do some studies looking at just the changes in blood chemistry related to fatigue. We worked on a group in Taxcala, Mexico, of work mules that work at a very high elevation. That's the other thing. The mules adapt quicker to high elevation than horses do. So I think that helps with some of the endurance as well, depending on the location of it, like the Tevis.
So just for fun, I know. I'm looking at a photo that you shared with us, and I think this donkey that I hope it's you riding is adorable. But and you talked about their necks, but they're not very what I call upheaded, which is what some people in the competition world are looking for. Is that breed specific within the donkeys? Because you talked about how many different versions there were. Can you find a show donkey that is more upheaded and can be competitive against, I don't know, whatever other kind of breeds might be in an open class?
And Julie, if you're referring to the picture on my background here.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a mule, and his mom was half Belgian warm blood and half quarter horse, and his dad Andalusian donkey type. So he's very level, and the nice thing with that, it works well, like in the hunter classes, definitely most of the Western classes. But you can just, like a horse, select for a more upright head and neck set. It just depends on what you're looking for and what you want to compete in. So yeah, he's pretty level across his top line, but I like that with him because it's easier than to get him on the bit and be round, and he goes forward really nice.
Makes perfect sense. I had a good friend, and her grandmother gave her, I'm going to say, a donkey when she was a kid. And she said, I had no idea how long donkeys live. So tell me, how big is a commitment to a donkey? You think it's cool, but it's got a long life.
That is a great point. They have a long life, especially if we care for them well. They can easily live 30 to 40 years of age. So, kind of like having a parrot. They may outlive their owner. So you need to have a succession plan and include your donkey in your will and trust.
And so we've been talking about donkeys and mules, and I want to make sure our long ear lovers out there know we're not purposefully ignoring hennies. So
thank you, Emily.
mules are a donkey dad and a horse mom, and hennies are a horse mom or a horse dad and a donkey mom. Dr. McLean, do we see hennies competing, or is that combo a little different physiologically? What's going on that side of things?
Yes, for sure. And thanks, Emily, for bringing up the hennies, because I am fascinated with hennies. I really, really like them. And again, we've done some studies trying to look at them physically and identify hennies to mules, because from a physiological standpoint, there's some differences in hennies compared to mules. So they're not really the same. Like, their body temperature is different. Some of the blood chemistry is different. And so there's probably more hennies among us than we know. And I actually wrote an article one year that my favorite mule was a henny. And it was from a mule trainer down in College Station, Bryan area. His name was Walter Nunn, and he sadly passed away this year. But he had a henny named Lemon that he competed on in cutting, roping, and cattle events. And I don't remember the breeding of the henny, but the idea a lot of breeders had, they would take top-notch, the best, like quarter horse stallions or a warm blood stallion, and then breed it to a donkey and get an outstanding individual. I mean, similar to the side of the mare side of things. But yes, there are hennies too. They compete at mule shows. They just sadly get lumped into that mule category.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. But a lot of people who breed hennies, they like hennies even more than mules. So they're very passionate about them.
Okay. So just out of curiosity, if somebody's listening to this, and our audience is thinking, this is intriguing to me, where do you go to find a great show donkey, mule, henny? Where do you try one out? What are you supposed to be looking for?
Oh, I love that. That was such a great question I saw that came through. It's hard. It's kind of like finding a diamond in the rough. And my mule, for example, his breeder, she's from Virginia, and she bred him to be a trail riding mule, and he's really tall. And my friend Debbie, the breeder, is not quite as tall. So I was like, well, this, so they taught him where he could get on a stump and get on and off him. And he like side passes over the fence. So that wasn't going to be a problem. But anyway, where do you find one? He was found on social media just when he was young in his foundation training. Some great mule and donkey trainers, people there in North Carolina had them, Noel Salmons and Brandon. And so you just have to keep your eyes open. There are special sales just for mules. mostly out west, but there are a couple, there's some breeders around, but it's really specialized. So when you do find one, you've really found something special. And what to look for, you know, movement's really important to me. I want a mule that can lope or canter really nice with forward motion.
Yeah.
Because being part donkey, you know, we're into conserving energy. So they naturally don't move good at the lope or the canter. Then we have, it's harder to ask them to be as athletic. And that's where some of them fall short. The same is true for a show donkey. You want a donkey that steps off and it lopes off. You don't want it to trot, then maybe lope and come back. Because if it has that strong flight instinct, then generally they're easier to train and more trainable. And then their mind is super important to me. I've been fortunate. I've had four or five really phenomenal show mules, and their minds have varied. The mule I have right now, Sarge, his mind's great. He's like, all right, whatever you want me to do. It's no problem. I got it. And I love that about him. And he's smart. He's so smart. You train him to do something and he's like, okay, all right, what's next? And he wants
He's very handsome. I feel like we should put a picture of him in the show notes. Everybody can see how handsome he is. Really, yeah. Really cute.
Oh, thank you. That was actually my first show with him at the Pinto World Show. It was my first class and he won it unanimously. And that was so exciting.
Okay, before Julie asks her follow-up question, and this is what happens every time we talk to you, because I feel like we just get so excited about this new perspective of the industry that we don't get eyes on very often. I think people think, okay, they see, you know, free donkeys on Craigslist or whatever, and I'm not sure, unless you're in the mule or donkey world, if you can truly appreciate, like, the value these animals bring to the industry. So if I wanted to go buy a nice show mule, what would I be looking to spend?
Yeah, it's another great question, Emily. And sadly, they're truly not valued what horses are. I don't know a horse out there that does all the events that my mule does. And if I wanted to buy a quarter horse that did at least two or three of the events that he does very well, you know, you're easily going to spend six figures, $100,000, $200,000, if you can even find one. But in our mule world, you know, some of the more expensive show mules have sold for like $40,000 or $50,000, and they're good mules. Are they the best mules? I don't know. But on average, most mules are bringing about $20,000 to $30,000. And
which I think is still a lot more than what people might expect. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. But again, from a horse standpoint, that would be a $100,000 horse. So I dream of the day that they're worth what horses are, because it also takes a lot of time and effort to train them to do all these events. And you know, I've got probably 7 years of training in Sarge, and he's finally, I would say, almost finished. So it's a real dedication to do all those events, and it's a lot of training, and you think about the cost of training. So
you have prompted two questions, not just one, Emily. Question number one is, if we're looking around for the best mule, donkey, henny, is there a breed association? Is there somewhere to go look instead of just going to social media to see what somebody's listing, where you might not know so much? I mean, is there some way to see their, I don't know, registration papers that makes you say, oh, I see. And this is great. So that's number one.
Okay. So with that question, there's a couple of different associations, because people that own mules and donkeys, they don't seem to fit in a box. They're pretty unique, like they're animals. So the Nationals, which is a North American Saddle, Mule, and Donkey Association called NASMDA. It used to just be NASMA, but then it was like, you know what? Donkey plays an important part in producing mules, are part of the show, so it became NASMDA. Anyway, their national show is in Tennessee, Harriman, Tennessee. It used to be in Shelbyville, but it's moved to Harriman. And I think shows are good places to go, meet people in the industry. You've got donkey breeders there. You have mule breeders there. You can see the animals in action and see some of the trainers. That show is in July. That's a good place to go. The World Mule Show is in Bishop, California. That's in May. there's breeders, there's competitors there as well. And then there's the American Mule Association, and they have some sanctioned shows. If you go to Texas, you have a Texas group, the Southwest Donkey and Mule Society. So it's somewhat regional. There's two big national organizations, but it's still somewhat regional. And like I said, getting mule and donkey people to conform sometimes is a bit of a task.
Okay, so I'm just going to put a little plug in, folks, that when I was looking for my last dog, I wasn't sure what breed I wanted, and I had a friend, and she introduced me to some regional dog shows where I can see lots of breeds, see them compete, help me figure out sort of what worked for me. So I encourage you, check out what Amy is suggesting. There, when you go to one of these things, you'll see lots of things, and you can totally say, this one, you can meet people, you can sort of delve into the thing. My second question, before Emily gets back on track here, is, are there some crosses that are better? I mean, do you put a donkey or a mule together with a Morgan or a quarter horse? Or is there, if you're trying to get a particular, I don't know, personality, for lack of a better word, a particular mindset, is there some formula?
And I think, so this is a really good question, because you talked a lot about, Amy, about how the donkeys are being bred to produce better mules. Are there horses being bred to produce better mules?
Yeah, there you go.
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
You're the expert.
I don't know. I really like that idea. I feel like from the horse world, I always get the question, hey, our horse has all these genetic disorders. Can we breed it and make a mule? I'm thinking, no, we don't want that in the mule world.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Okay. So, yeah, you definitely, you know, the mare counts. The mare power to me is so important.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And people forget about that. They get so excited about the stallions and the sires. And yeah, that's important too, but it takes two great individuals to hopefully produce another Secretariat, right? And with mules or hennies, you have one chance. You can't go back and keep breeding and breeding and trying to refine whatever it is your heart desires. So in my opinion, you better pick the best of both worlds. And again, with the donkey and a Jack, or even a Jenny, if you're making a henny, the mind, the attitude, the way they move, all of that's super important to me. And people forget that. They're like, oh yeah, it's a pretty black donkey. Great. Is it really pretty? Like, how long is its neck? How does it move? Because that's going to be translated in its offspring. And the same way with the mares. I mean, pick an outstanding mare. And I know some probably breeders, warm blood breeders, or even quarter horse breeders would just scowl at that idea, but it's another use for that breed. And again, you're going to make one hopefully amazing individual. And so whatever, if you want to breed to a Morgan, you want a Morgan mule, sure, go right ahead. I personally love this warm blood quarter horse cross with Sarge. This has worked out really well. In the past, my mules have been out of quarter horse mares or appendix bred type quarter horse mares, and they seem to be more trainable. So again, I've had mules that have had a little bit of like halter bloodlines, but also more performance. And that seems to help, because then you get nice confirmation, but then you also get the mindset of the performance horses.
So Amy, tell us, what is your favorite show memory with your mule, donkey, henny?
Oh, my favorite show memory. Oh my gosh. Oh, there's been a lot of them. I think though, some of the, this memory with this mule here, Sarge, at the Pinto World Show in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was really special, because it was my first time I got to show him. So I was so nervous. And I had an amazing mule named Wild Bill that I lost in 2014. He colicked, his stomach ruptured. He walks off the trailer. The vet's like, oh, his heart rate's only 50. He looks perfect. But couldn't be saved. And he had just won the world, the all around, three times in a row, and he'd won everything under the sun. But it took 7 years to find another really special individual, and that was Sarge. And he wasn't for sale, and his owner Debbie cried when she sold him to me, and I loved it. She's like a sister now. And anyway, when I got to show him, he had been shown, but every time he showed, he won. And so now it's my turn to get to show him. And I was getting over COVID. This was in November 2020. I was getting over COVID, and he had just had a surgery on his hock. He'd gotten a splinter in his hock. And Idaho Equine did a wonderful job. I just shout out to them for getting him back on track and being a stoic mule. We kept going, what's wrong? What's wrong? I was like, something is wrong. This is orthopedic. Anyway, so we had all those challenges, and it was the first time I'd shown him, and he went in and he won. And that was really special. I saved my number from that. And he is one.
I don't know so about much. You, but I bought a horse a couple of years ago that had won and won and won. And I'm an amateur. And so the first time I went in the ring with this horse, I had so much anxiety, so much nervousness, because I was like, this horse has had such a great career. I don't want to be the one to break this. So I totally get where you're coming from. Like, yeah.
And I have not bought mules in the past because of that. But Sarge was starting out on a clean slate. He was a 3-year-old when we bought. So, but like I said, he went in the show ring. He went in the Denver Stock Show. He won all of his junior classes. I don't remember where we went from there. I think it was Reno. And then we went to Tulsa. And yeah, so the pressure was on. But he's just really been a star. The past year, he's won a couple big high points against horses. And that's been really fun. We actually stopped showing the mule circuit last year to try our hand at something different and to keep challenging ourselves. And the horse show world out here has been very welcoming and open arms to us coming and showing. So I greatly appreciate that.
Well, so then this is a good segue to our last question, because I think there was some news about rules being changed so donkeys can compete in USAF hunter jumpers, maybe. But what still needs to be done for us to see more mules and donkeys in the show ring? And maybe kind of relay that to why we don't see a lot of mules in the show ring with horses right now.
Yeah, it's a great question, Emily. So currently you can show at different open horse shows. The one I show out here is called Golden Grand, and a lot of other open all breed shows are very open to that. World Ranch Horse allows mules to show. US, the Western Dressage. There's a lot of different groups working equitation. If you want to go to a USAF or a USHJA show, you can show in dressage and you can show in jumpers, but it's not available yet to show in the hunter ring. And we're hoping one day they'll open that up as well. And there's been a rule proposal on that. It's past the first level of USHJA. And again, people wanting to show their mules at horse shows, it's not about really beating the horses. It's about exposing more people to mules. And it's just another area, because not everybody lives in California where there is a mule circuit, or, you know, where some of these state fairs. So people just want to get out and enjoy their animal, just like you want to enjoy whatever breed of horse you have. So yeah, I would just encourage you to look at some of the shows in your area. Schooling shows are a great place too. We went to Hunter Jumper Schooling Show last year, competed in the jumper division. But I would love to be able to participate in the hunters, because again, mules really don't go fast. Yes, they're racing mules and things like that, mules used in Gymkhana, but it's also not my thing. I want to go slow and pretty over the fences. I don't want to sneak around. And my brain can't remember where to go, even though there's numbers. It doesn't flow like a hunter course. So yeah, those are just some of the opportunities out there. And I think always working with show management and other competitors is really important too. So
I have one more question before we close this, Amy. And it's only not about mules and donkeys, but it's related. So we were so disappointed, and we're sending a letter, I promise you, that UC Davis has decided that their Division I equestrian team is going to be basically retired, for lack of a better word. And yeah. So I didn't know if there were any mules and donkeys that were used on the team, and or if you have some advice or suggestions other than us letter writing and campaigning to get people to understand that the pipeline for our young equestrians are these programs that come through the universities like this. These make our elite equestrians, you know, going forward. So, thoughts?
Yeah, thank you, Julie, for bringing that up. It's a really sad, devastating situation. It pulls at my heart. These are students in my classes or student athletes. Mm-hmm. I've done research for their horses. And my mule, Sarge, was used in one of their competitions against my alma mater, University of Georgia, Go Dogs. And he was in the reigning competition. And our student athlete, Macy Newcork, she actually won her point on Sarge in the reigning. So that was so cool. So, yeah, NCAA allows mules to be used in their competition. Thank you. But it's really, this situation is devastating for the future of the equine industry. It's really heartbreaking for California. We have one other D1 division team out here that's at Fresno State. And it's a great team and a wonderful opportunity. But there's only one other school on the West Coast. So it's going to force our students to go back east. Nothing wrong with that, but the fact they've lost the opportunity and our team was ranked number 7 in the country, it's just really upsetting. As we know, anything equine is expensive, and it is an expensive sport, but they had a wonderful booster club of parents and supporters, and so they were bringing in the money for the team. I'm just very sad to see this decision made for a university that's known for our vet school, our ag program, our mascot's a horse. And I was so excited when the team was actually brought here. I was on the first search committee for the coach. And like I said, it's just very, very sad. The parents have put together a petition. There's over 20-something thousand signatures. There's a GoFundMe page. We are so grateful for all the publicity from the loss of the team that it's brought, especially through social media and from the industry. But I know there's a lot of industry partners and stakeholders that are just as concerned as we are as supporters of this team, because what does this mean for the future? And, you know, these horses increase the caseload at the vet school. Like I said, I used them for a great enrichment study we did that represents stalled horses and performance horses, how to improve their environment. And now that opportunity is gone here on campus. And it took the opportunity from the student athletes to be involved in research like that. I could go on and on and on, but yeah, I think signing the petition, writing letters. Also, I think, as y'all know, you're so active, the American Horse Council is in legislation. I really think reaching out to legislators here in the state of California would be important as well.
So we're doing all of that. And I want to let folks know, if you want to know more about this, if you want to know what steps to take, Emily's the lead on this. We're drafting a letter to go to with us and USEF and IEA and others. We really want people to understand this is the pipeline and we really need to stand up these programs. We've been doing a lot of due diligence to try to figure out how we make our case. So contact Emily. Her email address will be in the show notes and she's happy to talk to you about it. Share the letter, tell you how to find the petition so you can sign on. But lean in, folks, please.
Well, and we'll put the petition in the show notes as well. Yep.
Thank you. Thank you. So, Amy, we so appreciate your time and your expertise and your love for the industry and your love for the mules and the donkeys and the hennies. And we look forward to seeing you soon.
Well, thank you, Julie, Emily. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate all your great efforts on all these levels. It's just really appreciative and welcome. So.
And I feel like we'll just say until next time.
Exactly.
I think we're turning into a donkey special once a year.
I love that. Thank y'all so much.
Thank you. So our legislative and regulatory update for this episode comes to us from Markel Insurance. Markel has proudly served the equine community for over 50 years, providing insurance for horses, horse-related businesses, mules, donkeys, hennies. Nobody's excluded here. While your focus might be on your equid, let Markel protect you. Contact Markel today for insurance solutions for your equids, your farm, or any of your equine business needs. Visit MarkelHorseAndFarm.com or call 800-842-5017 to obtain a quick and easy quote from our knowledgeable team. So our legislative and regulatory update for this episode, we are tackling an issue that may sound technical at first, but has a very real consequence for patients, families, and licensed therapy professionals across the country.
And this is about how outdated insurance coding, which can sound complicated, is blocking access to medically necessary care. And so this is specifically therapy services, so doctor-prescribed services that use equine movement, often referred to as hippotherapy.
And what you really need to know and why this matters is because, let's start with some real-world examples, because this isn't even possibly theoretical.
Yeah, we have to put it into kind of context for you. So a good story is that in 2017, a licensed speech-language pathologist was providing medically necessary speech therapy to children with special needs. And like many physical therapists, occupational therapists, and other speech-language pathologists, she sometimes incorporated equine movement or hippotherapy as one tool within this broader treatment plan based on a physician referral and a physician evaluation and established practice standards.
So the downside to this is she was billed those services correctly. She did everything she should have under the standard speech therapy codes. But her insurer, which was Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield, later demanded she repay more than $87,000, claiming she should have used a different code. That code was S, as in Sam, 8940.
And here's the critical issue. That code, S8940, is an automatic denial code. Using it guarantees non-payment, regardless of the medical necessity or patient outcomes. And that demand from Blue Cross Blue Shield triggered years of litigation. And although the case was eventually dropped in 2024 because of the statute of limitations, the damage was already done. The therapist lost her practice, the kids with needs lost access to essential services, and her practice had to close.
And I think she lost her peace of mind over the whole thing. This was just so wrong. So unfortunately, the situation is not that unique.
And across the country, licensed physical therapists, occupational therapists, and speech and language pathologists integrate equine movement into treatment plans for neurological, developmental, and physical conditions.
These services are medically necessary, they are evidence-based, and already eligible for Medicaid reimbursement when billed appropriately.
So, Julie, what could possibly be going wrong?
Oh, the root of the problem is an insurance-generated code. It's S8940, created more than two decades ago under the HCPSC Level 2 system. That sounds complicated, so talk about that, Emily.
So the language in that code is what's fundamentally flawed. First, it incorrectly groups licensed medical professionals with therapeutic riding instructors. And we love our dear friends over at Path International, who are therapeutic riding instructors, but they are operating under a different scope of practice. They're not providing medical services as prescribed by a doctor.
So the second point is that it treats hippotherapy as a standalone service instead of what it actually is. It's a clinical tool designed to be used within occupational, physical, or speech language therapy treatment plans.
And so that's the important part. So then the entire plan, not just as one specific part. And so the third and final part is it labels these services as experimental, being an insurance-generated code, despite decades of peer-reviewed research demonstrating their effectiveness.
So the result is this widespread automatic denial, even when equine movement is just one component of a comprehensive medical necessary therapy plan. So the American Horse Council, along with PATH International, which is the Professional Association of Therapeutic Horsemanship, is also working with the American Hippotherapy Association, and we are trying to address this issue. PATH and AHA, American Hippotherapy Association, engaged Blue Cross Blue Shield, and they have acknowledged the code is problematic, and they have agreed it needs to be fixed.
However, and there seems to always be a however as we kind of chase the tail on this problem, There's concerns about potential legal exposure on Blue Cross Blue Shield side that has stalled progress. And because Blue Cross Blue Shield also chairs the HCPCS Level 2 Coding Committee, efforts to formally delete the code are potentially delayed indefinitely if you go through the correct process.
So at the state level, this landscape is so uneven. It's so all over the place. 37 states potentially allow Medicaid reimbursement for therapy services using equine movement, but only Colorado has explicit legislation requiring coverage when services are provided by a licensed PT, OT, or SLP, or a speech language pathologist. So that inconsistency leaves patients vulnerable and providers at risk simply for delivering appropriate care.
So, Julie, tell us, what needs to happen next?
Oh, this is so complicated. First, we really want the S8940 code should be removed from the coding system. Second, we want equine movement must be accurately defined at the federal level as a therapy tool, not a separate or experimental service. And finally, legislative action is needed to protect patients' access to care and give providers clarity and confidence when they bill.
So at its core, this issue is about patients and making sure they're getting the appropriate care and not about the paperwork associated with it.
Absolutely. When outdated insurance language overrides clinical judgment, children lose services, families lose support, providers are pushed out of the system.
The American Horse Council is going to continue working with our partners to fix this because access to medically necessary care should never hinge on something like a poorly written code. But we also need all of our friends out there in the horse industry to stay up to date on this issue because we guarantee you there's someone you know out there being affected by this.
Thank you for joining us today. We'll provide more numbers and links and information in the show notes. We invite you to support our beloved industry and join the American Horse Council. You can earn a free subscription to our monthly newsletter, which shares the latest in all legislative happenings, federal, state, and a whole lot more information that horse owners like you need to know about.
And you can follow the American Horse Council on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly Twitter, and LinkedIn. And you can also subscribe to this podcast's RSS feed. And you can subscribe to Horses in the Morning on any podcast player and find all the shows, including ours, on the Horse Radio Network at horseradionetwork.com.
And as we wrap up, we'd like to say, as we always do, we are hashtag here for horses, but also mules, donkeys, and hennies. Talk to you next month.